Hello and welcome to Kitchen Curiosity. I'm your host, Radford Chancellor. On the fourth episode of this show, we're recording live in our studios in Canary Wharf, London. And I'm joined by a highly respected French chef, as well as an individual from the food service industry who's a force to be reckoned with. We're going to be discussing their careers, businesses, food and beverage trends, and this episode is kindly sponsored by Instanta, part of Zipwater UK. My first guest announced his ambition to be a chef at the age of just five. He's an award-winning French chef, and might I just add, he's a highly recognised Michelin star chef since 1990. He's got regular feature on Saturday Kitchen and worked all over the world with notable residences in Singapore, Portugal, France and the UK. He was executive head chef of the highly accredited Vineyard at Newbury and has also been awarded Master Chef of the Year. He's regularly featured at events all over the world, showcasing some of his culinary flares, including the Regency Intercontinental in Bahrain and the Fine Food and Gourmet Food Festival in South Africa. It's an absolute delight to welcome Daniel Gamiche to the show.
Thank you
and
so much.
It's a pleasure to meet you in person, finally.
Yeah, finally, yes.
You've made it through the train strikes.
I made it, yeah.
So,
a bit overload, but that's okay.
Good. Okay. So, the last guest, Stephen Monkley, was on the show.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as you might know,
I like Stephen, actually.
You know him?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he knew you. He smiled when I said you were on the show.
He's a good guy.
So, as you might know, the guest of the last episode asks the question to the next guest.
Okay.
So, in this case, it was Steve Monkley,
yeah.
Chef Director of Salon Condé and Vice President of the Craft Guild of Chefs.
Correct, yeah.
And he asked you, and I think there might be a slightly loaded question to this, but what was your favourite kitchen?
It's always a tricky because in every single kitchen, you will learn something different because of the style of the chef. So favorite overall, probably where I was an apprentice in France.
Okay.
In a town called Luxeuil-les-Bains, which is in the east of France near the Swiss border. And my second kitchen, probably the Gavroche in London, when I was a young 19-year-old guy and I made it across with what I thought was a good English, and suddenly I met somebody in a taxi who was Cockney, and I didn't understand anything. So I guess it's two kitchen, but all the kitchen I've been working, training first before I become a head chef and run four Michelin star restaurants. It's just, they're all so different, but all interesting. Some of them are tough. Some of them are more tough.
Who are you working with at Le Gavroche?
Both Michel Leroux Senior and Albert.
Okay.
At the time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so
yeah,
wow.
That's tough.
So they don't take prisoner, I can tell you.
No, they don't.
But a fantastic experience. I loved it.
So, Daniel, I mean, you're a highly accredited chef, one of the first in the UK to have Michelin stars, kind of before it was even a big thing. You were there.
Yeah, we were having them. we were only 16. Actually, my first Michelin star was in Scotland when I was in Nottingham Lodge Hotel in Port Patrick near Stranraer. And when we were awarded Michelin star 1990 for the season 89, we're only six Michelin stars in Scotland, including Nick Nairn and
cool.
Betty Allen and Andrew Wilson and all these kind of people, and 18 in England. So
really early
it was
days.
Really, really only 20 something odd in UK, which is
quite an accolade, really.
Yes, I'm very proud of it. Of course, it was. I was only 29 or 30, whatever. Yeah, cool. So it was good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about your sort of culinary style and, you know, what drove you into cooking at the age of five as well?
Well, I didn't recall saying that. My mum told me that, and my great aunt, when one day I walked in the kitchen and I just said that for some reason. I ignored totally. So everybody had a good laugh and said, okay, of course. Yeah, yes. And, my great aunt used to own a small holding. It was only for family, only for friend, and not a commercial farm. And we used to be there every Sunday. She was a great baker. And I didn't like the work in the field with my great uncle. So I was always attracted by the smell from the kitchen. And so I used to escape that path and go to the other one. And I think I loved it. And my mom as well used to be a really, really good cook, because in France at the time, a bit less now, I'm afraid, but in France at the time, everybody cook at home.
Right.
Like in Italy, these two country together. I mean, it's everybody's cooking from young age, and you're working with grandma and mother and daughters and everything, you know. So it's very interesting, and I've always been interesting. I'm a gourmand, I'm a bon vivant, and okay. I live in a region which is bordering Alsace, Jura region. It's all about wine and food and all the farm, all the auberge in the mountain. You go and stop and eat some local stuff, which is amazing. So I guess that's a reason. And at the age of 15, I just left home to do my first three years apprenticeship, because at the time it was 3 years in France, not 2 years.
Yeah.
And tough. But very
and then at an early age, you came to the UK.
Well, I wrote to different kind of Michelin star around Europe because that was already my background. And people at the time used to recommend each other. It was just phone call. Is Daniel Worth coming in here? Yes or no? You know, it's not like nowadays. People move from a place to another for 50 quid, for example. But at the time, it was only a recommendation, and you had to be good to be able to recommend it.
Yeah.
But when I arrived in Gavroche, I mean, it was another game. I mean, it was tough. They had 2 Michelin star already at the time.
Yeah.
One of the only 2 star in UK, of course. And Albert and Michel Rougenier were very tough, very nice, very just, but really hard work and a lot of learning, which was perfect.
Yeah.
And all the team was French at the time, actually, in the Gavroche, whether it's a front house or the thing.
Seriously?
So I was among all French people, difficult to learn English or to ameliorate my English because,
I mean, is it true that you were due to go to Sweden? Is that right?
Well, before I came in UK, but that was before my first head chef position in Scotland.
Right.
Because I used to work in Sweden for doing a demonstration at the time. Because when I finished all my apprenticeship and all my exam and everything, I won a kind of a regional award, and I had to represent my region and the food for my region abroad. And we work with a Scandinavian airline system and a French embassy in Malmö, Lund and Gothenburg. And I was doing demonstration and cooking guest chef already at the age of 21. It was really tough.
Really? Yeah.
But very interesting. I learned a lot and I really loved Sweden and it was very interesting. And, I couldn't get my visa because that was the time of the Kosovo War and all this. So a lot of Yugoslav went to Sweden and they had a big influence and they stopped a bit.
It was before the sort of free movement.
Yeah, absolutely.
Europe.
Yes.
So you worked in we talked about many amazing venues. Just talked about including the Vineyard in Newbury and the Lofteland as well.
Correct. Yeah, and Clifton.
Can you tell me a bit about your time working in Berkshire? Those two different venues.
Yeah, well, I came to Berkshire from Harveys in Bristol. I ran Harveys for nearly 10, well, maybe not 10 years, but seven, 8 years. We were the only Michelin star in Bristol for a very, very long time. And Martin Brunos was just outside Bristol with a 2 star. And so we were the two really guys working really hard. But there's a lot of different restaurants in Bristol and all made for every palette and every kind of level of dining. But it was really interesting. I actually love my time at Harveys. Probably my best time in the restaurant world, because I was running that with the same team for 8 years. I was very lucky, never lost any staff, and we were very solidly understand each other, know where the boundaries are. And it was very interesting. It was owned by Harveys, a Harveys family, but also Allied Domecq, which used to own Harveys and the brand, which was a competitor of Diageo at the time, the two biggest in the world. And the reason I left is because Allied Domecq sold Harveys Bristol Cream Brown.
Okay.
And because the restaurant was Harveys, part of Harvey Wine Cellars, they closed the restaurant.
Right.
The year we were tipped to have 2 star.
Oh, wow.
So that was a bit of a blow. But nothing you can do when you work with big corporation. And
No, nothing.
They seem to cut the grass under your feet and you can't. So I wanted to buy the restaurant, which I could at the time, and they said, no, it's part of the brand, and it's still closed nowadays since 2002.
Cool, what a shame.
Like big company do, they don't give
if
you know what I mean.
And so did you go to Lofteland first?
I went from there to Lofteland with the same team in a hope of working hard to get the second star.
Is that when John Burton Race was there? No.
After John. And I tried to buy it with the owner of Nokinam, which I was previously, where I got my first Michelin star. And when we came and sat down, the owner decided not to sell anymore, but to lease.
Okay.
So we just packed up our stuff and we left. And I went to Clifton.
Okay.
And I stayed there nearly 6 years or 7 years.
Right, okay.
And we were the only Michelin stars in Clifton since then. Nobody has retained the star in Clifton since we left. So, yeah, good time. And good I like Berkshire. I was settling quite well in Berkshire. I've done three establishments there. And, good time.
Enjoyed it.
Well, it's a nice county, isn't it?
I know you don't want to give too much away, so I'll give you two choices on this question. what's either the most complex menu, or you can answer both together, the most complex menu you've done in your career, or alternatively, is a kitchen disaster that you're prepared to share with us? We've all had them, but...
You always got kitchen disaster, not necessarily because of your fault.
No.
Wow. A difficult one because the menu, complication menu. I mean, when you do guest chef, it is complicated because you go to a foreign country, a foreign kitchen with a foreign team, in a sense, foreign, i.e., because you don't know them.
A different kit and layout.
Yes, and layout and everything. So that's always challenging. And I still do that nowadays and tend to take always the same chef with me, who used to be my head chef when I was at L'Ortolan and Le Vignard, sorry.
Okay.
And, but that's challenging because you need to do the menu. I generally tend to use only the local language, if possible.
Okay.
And it's always complicated because people ask you, because you do a guest chef and they pay you, and they ask you to do tasting menu for 5 days in a row with a team you haven't worked. So you need to go in advance. And so that is a hard part.
I don't know the skill set.
But also what is hard when you're in Michelin star environment, we trend every season to create the best menu possible. Sometimes we overcomplicate and we can't and we can't quite deliver what we thought was going to be an easy dish sometimes. Kitchen disaster, not on my side, actually, but I say that honestly, but one day we had a big gala dinner and serving the chicken was on the menu. And the person who was in charge of the chicken forgot 40 chicken.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So
you're short 40.
And it was for 450 people gala dinner. And we were short of 40.
So quite a big.
That was little bit of a disaster. Well, the guy had to run fast to do a lot of things.
Yeah.
So that was a bit embarrassing for everybody because suddenly nobody, all of us actually, didn't recount on that time because the main course was not part of what I was doing. I was on a fish section, as I normally have. So very challenging. And
how did you overcome it in the end?
Well, they had to go and buy
them to cook them quickly.
And that's it. Because they realized that at the end of the starter or something like that. So
okay, a little bit of time to turn it around.
Yes.
So this question's come from one of our listeners who I know you know well, Masoud Sen.
Yes, Masoud, yeah, of course. I work with him in the vineyard a little bit. He's a very nice guy. I like Masoud.
Where do you see technology in the kitchen going? And do you think that chefs are adapting technology and they're using it correctly at the moment?
There's quite a few points on that. I don't think we're adapting very well because we are a bit stubborn, like every chef are. And we think that cooking on gas is only the option, for example. But it is not the option. I think we need to, there's a lot of things to do. Not only everybody is talking sustainability, everybody, it's a nice word, it's very easy to use, but to be fully sustainable, it takes a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I can give an example. When I go to Bulgaria, I do guest chef in Bulgaria in a lovely small boutique restaurant called Dieci. It's an Italian guy. He's Italian, Colombian, American. Dieci for number 10 in Italian. And he's fully sustainable as of this year. But when I say fully sustainable, not only there is no food waste, not only everything he buys is sustainable, organic, but also he's got solar panel, which not only does the water, but does all his electricity. So he relies on that. He's got a 42 kilowatt.
Yeah.
And every service is done only on that. And when we do the mise en place, we need to allocate time for certain apparatus. He's got a board and he's got all the kilowatt of each of these machines everywhere.
Wow,
and depending on the day and the way it's fully charged and everything, we need to use the microwave, for example, at that time, the induction at that time, everything to be able to keep everything during the service
running.
And we had a trial last year when we've done that, and he had only 12 kilowatt, and we had to go back on a grid 3 times during the week. So he was not happy. I was not happy, but it was not a lesson for me, but a very interesting trial because I never came across a restaurant that. And it did teach me a lot how to use And the fact that he had a board on kilowatt on all his machine, I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah.
And so that tells you the length, what he's doing. And more thing he's doing. So when he arrived there, it was water, but he decided to hire somebody to try to find where water was within his 2 acres of thing there.
Oh, wow, okay.
And they find a well to 62 meters down, water running through because it's a bit unhilly. So,
yeah.
And so they made the well and everything, and the water is used for the kitchen.
Pumping it up.
And the dirty water from the washing is transformed into a filter and goes to feed the garden and all his vegetable and everything. Cool. That's fantastic stuff.
Yeah,
so, it's like really, so that is sustainable. Yeah. So we got a long way to do.
But then you look at the suppliers and all the
and the surplus and the suppliers. We need to look at the people which are really ethical and everything. And there's a lot of kind of cheating is maybe not the word, but people who claim they are sustainable or organic, whatever. And like I said, it's a big word. We can use this word very easily, you know, especially organic. When I judge the organic movement with other chefs, we realize and some of the farmer was rolling the carrots in earth and this and that to make it look and it was kind of, you know. So it was very tricky. But also there is a heat problem in the kitchen. And when you go to kitchen, and you would know that because that's what you do for a living, you go to a kitchen, it's always hot, even on afternoon.
Mm.
People complain, the chef, oh, it's too hot, I'm sweating, I'm tired. But the service of lunch just finished. People wipe the table, they go home, and everything is on.
Yeah.
The induction is on, sometime on low, the gas, sorry, on low,
yeah.
The oven still on low. Everything is on. Obviously, yes, it's warm. I mean, yeah. Instead of cutting everything and restarting.
Mm.
So that's one of the problem because we're using a lot of energy for nothing, mm-hmm. for sure. So it's all this habit we need to get used, and the same for the bean, the same for what we threw, we shouldn't throw, we should reuse everything. So, but people don't sometimes rotate the produce very well. Of course, some of them perish and you throw them away when you realize that people are queuing on a food bank, for example. You know, there's a lot of thing to address. And it's not going to happen overnight. But I think some of them are leading the way a little bit. I would say Adam Handling, for example, which is very conscientious of that. And like myself, Raymond Blanc, and other people, obviously, a lot of them are making a lot of progress.
That's I know you're very passionate about and you're involved.
Oh, yes, that's the reason Michelin is awarding the Green Star. But, but the Green Star is certainly that. I think there's so much more to do to have... For me to have a Green Star, you know, it's not only to buy organic and be sustainable and check your bean. I mean, there's a lot more, much more, but it's a good start.
Yeah.
And it's great that Michelin addressed it that. And I think for me that in the future, it will be not only one Green Star, but it will be like the red one, two or three. And I think that's the way it should go. And not that people will forget the red, obviously, but but I think it will be much more. Kind of noble in a sense to really go for the Green Star and not thinking of about the red because we have to do it. It's paramount. I mean, you can see everywhere what's happening in the kitchen, the heat and the wastage and some of the chefs who just don't know what they're doing and through things. I mean, there's a lot of improvement to do.
Yeah.
Massive.
So, I know you've got a ridiculously busy schedule. Can you give us a little sneak peek of anything that's coming up this year for you?
Well, yes, I'm doing quite a few things, but guest chef a little bit I'm doing. So I'm supposed to go to Macau very soon to do a guest chef in Wim Palace, like I do sometime with Shangri-La Group. I'm supposed to do, I'm going back in Bulgaria in October, twice actually. And consulting, I'm just middle of signing a deal with for small consulting for very interesting kind of boutique hotel. But I don't think they want to call that an hotel. There's only 7 grand suite within a monastery stroke stately home, which is very gorgeous, which is
a bit more special
12 minutes from home, which is just perfect, you know, which should be very interesting with a good team and good people. And they're using people who've done a Heckfield Place for all their refurbishment. So it should be very interesting.
Some nice,
Yeah.
The final question, and it's for this part of the show, it's something I ask all my chef guests. You're hosting a dinner party for 3 people, dead or alive, famous. Who are you going to invite and what are you going to cook?
Wow.
And why?
It's a difficult one because we all famous in our own right. We all individual.
True.
So famous is a big word as well.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Because obviously we always name the trade
and always
name the people, but
maybe just made them name them already. But there's a lot.
Yeah, but well, of course, Eston and Raymond Atto, my best friend. But when I was at Clifden, I cooked for a lot of stars, mm-hmm. and I really had a good time with Daniel Craig.
Okay,
because I used to cook in a private thing along the river where all the star come, and he was a very charming man. Same for Jude Law.
Well, people can't see everyone's going, wow, in the studio now.
The same for Jude Law. I think he's really charming. Yep. And So
Daniel Craig, Jude Law.
I would love Daniel Craig to be there, yeah.
And Jude Law, and maybe, can we throw in a chef? Or
I know Daniel Craig for Jude Law, maybe not, because I need to keep space for two other people.
And what sort of thing would we cook? Would you cook for them, do you think?
Very simple French regional cooking, but well done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like if it's winter, beautiful, proper beurre bourguignon.
Something very simple, with a nice mashed potato, with a bit of truffle
or something like that, for example.
Yeah.
A starter, probably a charcuterie from my region, which is fantastic. And the cheese from Franche-Comté, no?
Yeah.
You have to. Vacheron d'Or, Morbier.
That sounds lovely.
Comté. And a nice dessert, something like tatin, for example.
Yeah,
yeah.
Nice. Really nice. Well, Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time to this part of the podcast.
Thank you.
We're just going to take a short break, and then we're going to discuss with my next guest, come back to you, and we'll just discuss about food and beverage trends in the UK.
Oh, yeah, it's changing a lot.
Discover the essence of French gastronomy and the secrets of fine dining in your own kitchen with a collection of sensational cooking books by Daniel Galmiche. From revolutionary French cooking to the French Brasserie cookbook, Daniel Galmiche invites you on a culinary journey, unveiling the finest techniques, authentic flavors, and exquisite recipes that capture the heart of French cuisine. Purchase via Amazon or directly at danielgalmiche.co.uk.
Instanta's been around for over 60 years and manufactured the highest quality products in some of the toughest settings, including restaurants, hotels and catering operations. Instanta is part of Zipwater UK. Now, I'm joined by their business development manager, who's a lady who's a force to be reckoned with. She's a highly experienced food service professional working in the food service sector. She's a dynamic, notable industry expert and currently leads the food service equipment division for this brand. I'd also like to highlight that she currently runs and supports a community food bank. I'm happy to welcome Vanessa Clark to the studio. Vanessa, welcome to the show, and how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Bradford. Thank you for having me.
No problem, thank you for taking the time.
It's okay.
So tell us a bit about Instanta, your work in the business and your kind of journey, you know, how you got into things. So
I've been over 11 years now with Zip and Instanta. So started off as a commercial manager, basically out on the road with fit-out companies, M&E contractors, wholesalers, really just getting the product into specification and, you know, into office spaces. So obviously then it was lockdown. Lockdown happened, and Instanta had a team out there that were, you know, working with catering equipment suppliers. But like anything in that year, 2020, we unfortunately lost our sales team due to, you know, like the hospitality industry just completely dried up. So then Instanta was asked, last January, I think it was, if I wanted to look at, you know, heading up the Instanta brand. So Instanta itself has been around, like you said, over 60 years, UK manufacturer. So based in Southport.
Okay.
So a really tiny little place. Everyone who works there is from the area. Mm-hmm. Everyone who been there since they'd done the what used to be an apprenticeship.
Okay.
You know, YTS back then, wasn't it? Dave heads up the team up there, Dave Wilson, and they're really good guys. Everything's manufactured, a lot of products by hand. So they won't go out until they are, you know, checked. They're all really robust, stainless steel, high grade stainless steel. Yeah. So obviously through combination of innovation, quality and service, you know, we we've built this brand up for this many years, really, in the catering industry. So, we're in refiners in restaurants, stadiums, hotels, cafes, from drinking water solutions of countertop under counter, sous vides. So I don't know if you guys watched MasterChef last night.
It was on there.
Yeah, which was really good for us. So fingers crossed that we, you know, people now know that we do the sous vide systems as well. We're really, really busy, and it's good, and yeah, it's a great brand, and I'm really excited for what's coming with them as well. So yeah, so it's really good.
So I mean, Instanta, as you said, it's a brand with a great reputation. You know, can you kind of, I know you touched on that a bit, but what is it Instanta's doing differently in the market that really makes you stand out?
I suppose it's the customer journey. We do like to look at how we can be, you know, better than our competitors, which everyone has a competitor, and I do think healthy competition is good for everybody, really.
Yeah.
But I think where we succeed is obviously the innovation. We've always tried to be one step ahead of our competitors.
Yeah.
And the offerings that we have are, you know, quite dynamic. We were the only manufacturer of a unit that's over 135 litres,
right,
that we worked in collaboration with the MOD on. So that was really good.
Obviously, for hot water, for cold water.
For boiling mess. So if you've got the mess areas, obviously, high capacity. Obviously, not just for MOD and the mess areas. Obviously, can use in concert venues and stadiums. So, yeah, so we do have that. And yeah, so we're just slightly different. I think we've got a great team behind us as well. So like we said, Instanta, Zip Water is, you know, combined, and we're part of the bigger Culligan Water Group as well. So there's a lot that can happen. We get a lot of, got a great marketing team as well. So obviously marketing is key to, I think, as well, make sure that our product's at the forefront of everyone's mind.
Definitely, definitely. So, I mean, every week I feel that we're seeing some sort of new technology coming out in the market. And things are developing. Is there any notable innovations within your product range?
So we have the Instatap, which has gone from generation one, which we launched years ago, to generation two, which is great. So the Instatap itself used to just be a separate system of a boiling system that ranges from 10 litres up to 50.
Yeah.
And then we have the chilled, that's a 20 litre system. So very high demand areas. And we have just launched, which we all asked for, that the company delivered on it, is a boiling and chilled system.
To combine,
yeah. So, yeah. Which is great. So this product is really geared towards office spaces. So, yeah, you know, from a smaller system to try and eradicate plastic in these areas.
Okay.
And then also, you know, with our larger scale systems as well for conference centres. And it does have, so the innovation behind it is you've got the boiling and chilled system, you know, safety systems, antimicrobial system on it.
Wow, that's a word.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So try to say that.
What does that mean? Like antibacterial or?
Yeah. So it so 99.9%, reduction, so yeah, in bacteria.
Okay.
So when it's touched, yeah, so it reduces that. So that's one really good factor that we've got on that as well. But yeah, so we're seeing this product, you know, we're starting to manufacture more, and we're seeing them go out in projects. So it's really, really good. And yeah, like I said, we're trying to eradicate that plastic from workspaces. So, and this is a product that I would suggest to look at.
So I know you're busy at work. I mean, it seems to be traveling all over the place. And you're also busy outside of work. And I know you're involved in a food bank. Can you tell our listeners a bit about the food bank? What's your motivation?
So I got involved with Bruton Food Bank. So Bruton, Somerset is where I live. So it was started again that year, 2020.
Okay.
When we all had a bit of a shock to the system. So we saw people coming who were two-parent family, and both were working, but sometimes still couldn't make ends meet on furlough, you know, or someone then did get made redundant, unfortunately. And then it was set up by a lovely lady. She set it up, actually, a lady called Jane. And I sort of like just saw that she was advertising volunteers. So I thought, oh, I'll, you know, go and help her. So it's just me and her out of the Unius Club, which is in Bruton.
Oh, actually, you really were one of those.
Yeah, making up the bags and making up parcels. So how are we getting food? So basically we have Morrison support us really well. And then we do rely on local businesses. So we get bread from the local bakers, which is great. We get fresh vegetables from another community group that's in Bruton. And then we also have support of hot meals some days from a couple of the restaurants. So we always need more. We get a lot of support. October to December is our busiest time for, you know, getting support, because a lot of the schools support us. We've like the harvest festivals, the church, Christmas Aid as well. So I've definitely, I enjoy it. And then Jane was leaving, stepping down. So she said, would you like to take on the role as heading up the food bank? So I now head up the food bank. And then we've got about 7 volunteers now. So yeah, between us all,
it's a really, I mean, it's sad, so sign of the times, unfortunately, but it's a great piece of work you're doing to help families. Sometimes just ordinary people just need bit of help, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And I think we're seeing that. And, you know, there's been some success stories as well from us that, you know, some people have been able to, you know, say, I don't need your help anymore.
And move on.
And they're so grateful. I can't tell you how, like, it makes you feel. You just feel like your heart melts and you're like, you're so pleased for these people that have been able to really pick themselves up. And, you know, a lot of people have got children that, you know, we do Christmas stockings as well for Christmas, everyone got like vouchers for Christmas for the kids to spend. We're not just about food. We're about mental, because obviously mental health is big on it as well. So we try and support through the church as well. So there's a lot that we do for them. It's really good.
So what's next for Instanta? Any sneak peeks coming down the line for us?
Oh, there's lots of exciting things happening, which is great. And obviously you staying, I'm here, there and everywhere across the country. I have been since last January. Just recently taken on a new guy for the north, which is great. I can now concentrate on the south, and he's coming in from the industry anyway. So that's really good. We've got Lauren, who is my line manager. There's lots happening. We're talking about lots of things happening. You know, I can't give too much away, obviously,
because there is. But
you know, we're working closely with our buying groups that we're in, working with our catering equipment suppliers, some great projects and some really like high-end chains that we're speaking with, which is really exciting for me. And I get a bit too excited about thinking, oh God, I'm going to walk in somewhere and I'll see our products there. So it's good. And just watch this space for Instanta. We want to get back to where we were prior to lockdown, which is great. And it's just a great company. And everyone's like, has each other's back. So I think it's really good. I'm a little bit excited, as you can tell.
Perfect. No, fantastic, Vanessa. Well, thank you for that. Okay, so Daniel now rejoins Vanessa and I, and we're going to be discussing food and beverage trends in the UK and the wider field. So Daniel, start us off. A leading report stated that in 2021, 29% of consumers ate breakfast or brunch out, but in 2023, this jumped to 35%. This is a significant increase. What do you think's driven the increase in the breakfast trend in the UK?
For people to not cook at home and to go out for breakfast, you mean? That's what you're talking about.
Exactly, yes. I'm talking about.
Well, very interesting point, because when I lived not far away from Ascot before I moved back in the Chiltern Hills in 2020, there is a restaurant who does mainly only breakfast.
Okay.
On a weekend, you can't get in if you haven't booked queue. They do, I think they serve it until 2 o'clock. And that's where I realized and how popular it was, this restaurant, only for breakfast. I guess, and maybe people don't want to cook at home, some of them.
Yeah.
I guess maybe the value for money is good for breakfast. It does puzzle me, because me, I love my breakfast at home. I would never go out for breakfast unless I've got no choice. I am abroad or somewhere in an hotel and you got your breakfast, but I love cooking my breakfast, but not a fry up like everybody does, because I'm French, so I don't do fry up. I mean, there's a big love for fry up. I mean, it's very British. Sometimes I have that when I'm in a hotel, especially in Scotland. I love the Scottish.
Well, it's like an all-day meal, isn't it?
I love the Scottish breakfast.
Yeah.
That's for sure. So I can't say I never have fry up. It would be lying. I don't know. The main thing why people are going out for breakfast instead of doing it at home. Maybe it's a time scale. Maybe it's close to the workplace. Maybe they can get up a little bit later, get ready, go and thing, and
I think you're right. It's probably also like eating out. It's probably quite a good value for money eating out experience.
I think
really,
so.
If you had a full breakfast.
Yeah, I think so. And if you like people who take a big bowl of porridge on the morning and it can take them over lunch and they don't even need to have lunch, or I guess a really nice breakfast can take you up to the dinner almost, if it's, you know what I mean, if you got full. So it could be that you save quite a lot by doing so, actually. I mean, it's a good question. And I never really thought about that in detail, but it could be the reason.
Yeah. I mean, Vanessa, we Brits, we love breakfast. In fact, I think we spend more on breakfast than the whole of Europe combined, you know, like we love breakfast in the UK.
No, I wouldn't be surprised.
How do you see the beverage side of breakfast changing and kind of what's important going forward this year and next?
I think a lot of people now look at hydration when obviously through the day and sort of, so breakfast, I might sound a bit cliche here, but I do actually start my day with a glass of water, whether it's got lemon or my vitamins. And I'm quite conscious of my hydration through the day because, you know, we all are meant to drink like 1.9 litres of water a day and NHS recommendations. But again, being French, I would presume coffee would be your go-to drink to start with.
No, I don't, actually. Ah. Funny, my morning is warm water with ginger and lemon every morning.
Oh, okay.
And only half an hour after,
see,
I have my juice, which I make myself for a nice sealed season of blood orange. So I do a blood orange juice in the morning.
Nice.
And only after that, I get my coffee. And I put my fresh baguette in the oven, as always. I always have a fresh baguette. And after that, I use the ham from a shop. I don't buy ham, which I vacuum or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's an Italian shop who does a real, really ham from Puglia, which I buy. And that's my breakfast.
Sounds amazing.
And so now I'm very, very healthy, by the way. I'm one of those chefs. Really, really healthy. I don't have any fat. I don't have anything. So
that's impressive.
I think it does depend which country you're from as well, what your preference is with obviously beverages for, you know. I know speaking to my work colleague, he's a Polish guy called Artur, and his is coffee, you know. He says, but that's the way things are, you know, in Poland everyone just drinks coffee to start with, you know. But I, like I said, water is always, you know, Daniel said he starts off with water and ginger, you know, and lemon and ginger. I'm going to start the ginger. So I think I do see it as a change in sort of like market, I suppose. You know, and there's so many coffees around now, isn't there? You know, you don't just go into and you ask for a white coffee. It's like, do you want oat milk? Do you want coconut milk? Do you want soy milk? So, you know.
I remember when, if we're going back, years, when I was a waiter, when I was about 17, no, 16, and when all these Americans come in, they all wanted like chilled ice water. And I was like, what? For breakfast? What?
Yeah.
And we were all like, well, you know, it wasn't a thing then.
Yeah.
But now we're all doing it, aren't we?
Exactly.
So, it's a...
But water, I drink about 3 liters of water every day.
Yeah.
I drink a lot of water.
Yeah.
And I've got only 2 coffee in the morning and 1 espresso at 2 o'clock, generally speaking.
And you don't drink coffee after that?
No.
I think water is the way, you know. More, I know more children. My daughter Holly, she doesn't drink anything. All she drinks is water. Mm. Yeah. Nothing at all.
But the schools are pushing out.
Oh, she's 23.
But even so, the schools are pushing.
Well, it's good, man. My son was brought up like that. He never had any sparkling drink. Never had Cokes and Fanta and all this. Always water.
Okay.
And he's 24.
So, there we go.
There you go. But bone water, I mean, quickly like that, when I lived in Singapore, the first thing my local, because my team was half local and half foreign, because the way they have to have so many foreign for local people. And my head chef was Chinese. And the first thing he told me when I arrived, he said, drink a lot of water, but drink only warm water. He said, the reason behind that, you're in a very hot climate. And he said, a lot of tourists think they have had a lot of water, but suddenly they drink really cold water and there's a clash within the body. 37,
to heat it up.
So they straight away sweat and all the water they drank go out. And he said, that's why they're fading and collapsing, because they think they had water, but they didn't.
Yeah.
He said, you must always drink warm water, never ice water when you're in a very hot country.
Yeah.
And it was very right. I mean,
to let the body absorb it quickly.
Absolutely, it does, because it's the same level on your inside temperature, so there's no clash.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, the clash rejects all your water, so you sweat all out, and that's what you do. So I always do that. I'm rarely.
That's an interesting fact, actually. Yeah.
So Daniel, I mean, how do you see the food trends sort of developing this year? And is there any notable chefs that you know that are kind of leading food trends for this year? Well, it's about UK or
I know the trend is a word as well, which is the UK is a very different kind of market than all over Europe. The reason behind that, UK does take a lot of other country in a sense of fashion, if I may say that. So you can go now, it's tapas, it's fajitas, it's all this Bolivian cooking and Latin America is coming in big force. The only thing sometimes it is not completely accurate because it's all transformed for the English palate.
Okay.
So you go to Mexico and East Mexico, for example, and you can have some absolute fabulous food. Local food, and you come here, it's a little bit transformed. But I think the trend for me, first of all, I would love to see more organic, more sustainable, more support of the farmers, because there is not enough. And we've seen during COVID, and if it wasn't for those guys working super hard to supply everybody, every shop, whatever, we would have nothing.
Yeah.
So I would like to see a major support of that, even more than it is now, because it's not working. But food trend is very kind of a lot of is Japanese orientated now, a lot of is Icelandic. So I can see when I go to some of my friend places, there's always a small accent, like me when I speak English. But in food, very Japanese, very Asian, a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
Like Gary Ward, for example, I find he's very kind of Japanese orientated.
Yeah.
A lot of it are British produce because we've got fabulous produce in Britain. Like myself, I use at least 90% of British produce in mine.
Okay.
I don't import nearly nothing,
especially
when it's come to Scotland. They got such an array of produce, which is magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
Or Cornwall or Somerset or Dorset. I mean, there's a lot of things.
Yeah.
But I think the it's changing. There's a lot of kind of different dishes on the thing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You go to Claire Smith, for example, which is a fabulous chef. You got those three small things. You got to
so like small plates and
kind of small plates.
Sharing you got to, and that's it.
Yeah, you go to Pierre Gagné, it's the same. Adam Handling, all these guys are just doing mini thing, beautiful dishes, everything.
Yeah,
much more work, I feel. And sometimes you wonder who is the king of the plate? Which one is the one who should come out? Or is it an accompaniment?
Do you think it's like the diners are looking for like that more experience when they're out eating? Is that, or they're more discerning, or?
Well, there's two ways. There are a lot of people.
Or just chefs just doing being chefs.
Yes. And stubborn. but if you go to restaurants, there's a lot of tasting menu, for example, everywhere now. You can see, and since COVID, obviously, as we know, very difficult to get the staff, very difficult. People don't want to do a full two service anymore, and I quite understand. It's too many hours, and that need to be addressed still anyway.
Yeah.
But also because there's a little bit less staff and only one service, people will tend to do only a tasting menu. But not everybody like tasting, and it's kind of not annoying, but sometimes you just want sometimes one course.
Yeah, you just want
because you're
like
in a mood to go out. So you said, okay, let's not cook tonight. Let's go out. And you'd like to go in a place and you have one course and finish with your family, and you look at the bill and said, okay, it's acceptable for this month. I can spend that instead of cooking at home. But this tasting menu, and I'm a chef. So some of the short tasting I love. Long tasting menu, it is not my thing.
Okay.
I cannot be sitting there for 5 hours and have a 40 course, whatever. I don't see the point as a chef.
Yeah.
And maybe I was trained differently a little bit earlier than all this guy, but. But, you know, a short menu, I think, is much more interesting.
It's something more interesting.
Yeah, I understand there's no a la carte, the price of food, we know that.
Mm.
More you select, more you waste.
Yeah.
And I think also the fact that you repeat your testing every day, you can be very consistent.
Yeah.
And obviously for the guys who are all in a Michelin environment,
yeah,
they need to be super consistent. You're only as good as your last service. Everybody know that. And that's a key for Michelin, obviously, consistency across the board on the top of the rest.
Yeah.
So the trend, I think I've noticed a lot of a Scandinavian kind of style
twist
of cooking,
and,
a little bit of twist of Japanese. And like I said, Gareth Ward, for example, in Inisir, I had a meal there not long ago. It was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And he bring the produce are just amazing.
Oh, okay.
I mean, on the top of using British produce a lot, he brings some from Japan, which are just an unbelievable standard. Yeah, so I think that's what's happened.
Okay.
And of course, Latin American is coming as well. There's
okay.
a lot of very good produce, very good food, and it's starting. I mean, the array in London is bigger than any other capital, even Paris. Yeah. Doesn't have the array.
And that's coming from a Frenchman.
We don't have this variety. Yeah. I mean, Vietnamese is coming as well, but in France it was there because it's part of our heritage in a sense because of the colonies. But Vietnamese is coming very strong in here as well, and they do cook very well, cracking produce. So, a lot of good things. It's interesting. I mean, you can go around in London all the time. Yeah. There's a new restaurant. Which one we're going? Mm. So it's interesting for people, you know?
Okay. Well, thanks, Daniel. That's great. So, Vanessa, don't answer that question, water. No, I'm joking. So, you know, actually going back to water, like someone said to me the other day, like people moan about drinking 2-3 litres of water, but they're happy to go and drink 5 pints of beer. Yeah. So leads on to what, in your view, what people drink at the bar this year? What's the go-to drink when you go around your
I was a bit concerned when you gave me this question to answer. So, I think if I spoke to my family, for myself, I'm a bit of I do love champagne. Mm-hmm. And do like a cocktail. So I do think nowadays, there's all these, there's more wine bars, people, you know, and don't use pubs as much. It's more of a certain, area where they go to. And especially London, you've got so many different restaurants and bars. And again, where I live in Bruton, we've got some really fantastic small little bars. We've got the Chapel, which has got a cocktail bar downstairs. And so I think cocktails are definitely something that people look at, maybe gins. And then UK vineyards, well, obviously last week I went to a wine tasting in Wraxall Vineyard. And, more and more UK English wines are coming through and up. And and if you'd said that years ago, people say, English wine, obviously being from France, great wines.
Yeah.
So I think that trend of is definitely, is it a trend? Obviously, again, it's more sustainable to use for, I know we keep saying this sustainable word, but to be supporting our local, the UK with their wines as well. So yeah, it's interesting. I think, it's each to their own of what they drink, like you say, beer, do people still drink a lot of beer, or is it more, Guinness, and there's
cocktails,
loads of different
cocktails. It's cocktails, isn't it? You say wines, champagne.
I love
hopefully
champagne.
The Prosecco period's gone. Yeah. I don't think I'm Prosecco, of course, but.
Champagne Prosecco, the Prosecco gets pushed to the side. Champagne, please. Yeah,
should not even exist.
But that kind of leads on to the next question, and I've actually got something for you, Daniel. So I'm quite passionate about the English wine market. So it's good that you picked this up. So I actually bought this, which is for Daniel, Bottle of Nightimber. Now, I've got no connection to Nightimber at all, apart from I used to live at the back of their vineyard in Petworth. Mm. That is a beautiful wine.
So you can go and steal the grape.
Yeah, I went down and just kept buying the bottles. It was anyone's been to my house has definitely had a glass of Nightimber. What's your view on the UK wine market? I mean, and then if you compare, have you had Nightimber before?
Yes, I had the tasting when I was in the vineyard.
Okay, this wine already, so yes, I need to bring that.
Yeah,
as a Frenchman, it's quite interesting. Well,
the point you were just mentioning earlier, we need also to know that the reason is more vineyard in UK is because of the climate change. So obviously it does favour the people to make wine and to buy land and plant vine and everything, but in the same time, it's due to the warm climate and everything is getting warmer. You can see now in the south of France, people in summer are struggling even to live, even the local now buying in Brittany. It's a huge movement of that. So we know the climate is helping for that in a sense, but in the same time, there's not much we need to all work towards that. But I had quite a few tasting about English wine. We're talking about white, generally speaking.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And I do work with Danbury Estate.
Oh, yeah.
I do the harvest every year with them. And Danbury is the second oldest vineyard in UK. It's been planted in 1987, I think. And it's owned by the founder of Porsche, an Austrian family, because Porsche originally is Austrian and not German.
Yeah.
And so the founder of Porsche family bought the vineyard. And they run it, and I do the harvest. It's very interesting. They plant different kind of grape variety, including Austrian, from also Alsace and French. And so I do they got a great white, Mm-hmm. Very good white wine. They do a sparkling as well, which I'm not too keen because of the acidity still, I think. Yeah. But obviously, like we said, with the climate and everything's coming up, I think it will improve all the time. Mm-hmm. Some of them are already delightful. There's not in near Henley as well. There's a vineyard there and everything. So I like the white. I haven't tried the rosé. There's some rosé coming out. The red, I would say, it's a no-go for me.
Yeah. Not because it's just not
the climate for it. But a lot of House of Champagne are buying a estate in Kent and in Debenham, Somerset and everything, and planting grape. So to add to the grape, because there's not enough, probably in France as well. And so a lot of Champagne house are doing that.
Okay.
So, yes, but so I'm like you, I'm a champagne guy. Yeah. Okay. I absolutely adore champagne. I think for me, it's the ultimate wine for occasion.
What is your favorite one, though? What is your favorite champagne?
Bollinger.
Oh, yeah.
And the UK is the biggest customer of champagne outside of France.
Yeah, correct. Bollinger, RD, tradition, vintage. For me, is top of the top.
Anyway, enjoy the Nine Timber.
I have tried Nine Timber. One thing I would think with Nine Timber, I think they make good wine, sparkling wine, whatever. I would argue that the price is very expensive.
It is. A lot of this wine, for example,
is sold about £12 more than a Bollinger.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to compare.
Yeah.
So I think they are a little bit expensive.
But I think that is a lot of the English producers because they're smaller numbers.
And no, I know, but I mean, if we want British or English wine to be known a little bit more, I think sometimes they put the bar a little bit high on prices.
Yeah, yeah.
I know they've got a lot of progress, excellent white wine now, which are starting to be on the menu in all the Michelin star restaurants. So therefore, they're doing something really well. But I think the price sometimes can be a little bit steep. That's my only thing.
No, I agree. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. It's Vanessa. So, in the commercial sector, if we go and come away from wines and things like that for the moment, how do we see this drive for moving away from bottled water to dispense water? How do you see that changing?
Well, I think a lot of businesses now are aware of, you know, what plastics are doing to the ocean. I have got a few facts for you that that Culligan Water as a group. So they actually saved 2 billion single-use plastics from landfill in 2022. You know, the average person's using about 156 plastic bottles a year. So, yeah. So when you look at it that way and how long it takes to decompose, it can up to 450 years to decompose. So,
and Daniel's just showing us his bottle of water that he's bought in.
He carries all his own.
I think he needs a tap for his own home.
Correct. You see, this is the thing. I don't have that. I got a central thing. But my niece bought that for me a few years ago.
I just looked over at my Lewis and we saw something the meetings we have and the projects we get involved in, we've got some really big businesses that have, you know, over 300 staff now to provide, you know, plastic bottles and cans, especially, you know, you can even buy cans of water now, which are slightly more sustainable, obviously, but then the businesses then have to pay to get rid of all this, to recycle, you know. So again, they're saying they're being recycled. So, yeah, so we're seeing a massive trend, and every project that we now get involved in will always have a tea point that's got the boiling, chilled, and even sparkling. You know, we do a system, Zip Water do a system that also produces sparkling water.
Yeah.
So, again, no need for bottles of any sort, you know, glass or, you know, we're seeing restaurants who are having our chilled water systems installed, you know, giving out free water now because obviously, again, you know, everyone needs water to survive.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, yeah, I will not, you know, drink out of a plastic bottle. So, we're seeing sites where, you know, more and more plastic is being eradicated from office spaces, restaurants especially, you know. Again, restaurant owners are more aware of, you know, reducing their plastic intake as well. So,
okay.
It all ends up in the sea in particles, if you've done your reading.
And in the fish.
Exactly. We eat.
I agree with you a lot. And I think eventually everybody will have some kind of sort of system at home, whether it's sparkling. I love sparkling. I drink a lot of sparkling water. And we'll have the system and they can do their own thing. Me, I've got a Berkey, which I bought years and years ago, a 5-liter one, and I drink 5 liter a day of that one.
Right, okay.
Absolutely. And it's a double filter plus fluoride and everything. So, well, you probably know, and because that's what you do for a living. but also I carry always my bottle of water there. And I think essentially, and recycling, as you say, sometimes we don't know how it is recycled. And I'm afraid I don't quite believe that everything is recycled.
No, a lot of it is.
The way it should be.
Yeah.
You go to landfill and everything and you see what's there and you said, wow. And eventually I think we need to get rid. It's a reflex, actually. We've been brought up like that for generation. It's a bad reflex, plastic. And it's the same for cling film in restaurant and all that. I mean, people are using that like there's no.
The thing is, but it's so cheap to buy plastic bottled water, isn't it? You know, you can go to Aldi and buy it, and that's bad. So that, I think that will probably end up changing. This plastic bag situation, they'll start charging us extra.
And plastic bottled water does have a shelf life. So it does have a shelf life. So, you know, and obviously if you leave it out and, you know, there's things that could happen. So, yeah, filtered water all the way. That's
also supermarkets are not helping because not only the water, but you can still buy your cauliflower is in a plastic bag, your thing.
Yeah.
I think that should go out.
It's all changing.
You know, they need to do it. It has to be done.
So, leading on to a slightly different question, you know, I've been seeing in the last few weeks, some conflicting statistics around vegetarian and vegan diets. I've read some reports that it's increasing and some reports that it's decreasing. Daniel, what's your view on that?
I can understand. I've got my neighbours were a lot of them were vegetarian and now they are pescatarian because they realised something was missing in their diet.
Yes.
But they don't want to use meat, fair enough, but they're using fish.
Mm-hmm.
For different reasons, including omega and oily fish, etc., because we know that most of the vitamin, all the tablet is absolutely inefficient, except for the vitamin D3, which is the only one who can reach everything in your body. The rest is absolutely waste of time and waste of money. But you may as well have a balanced diet instead. Absolutely, 100%. But to be vegetarian, I can understand.
Mm-hmm.
But to be vegan, sometimes, unless there's super specific reason, medical reason. But I think there's a little bit of a fashion in that.
There is. A lot of it is kind of decreasing, I feel. A lot of it comes from
Hollywood and the stars and everything. And I got a lot of friends which are A-listers because my late wife was an actress, so I know about it. But a lot of things come from LA, fashion and people traveling and bringing things over. But there is also the fact that in Italy and France, they want to ban vegan food because they realize that in the process of making it, there is more danger than anything else, especially in Italy. They've done a big study on that and they realize that because what they mixed and they tried to make the flavor taste. Why would you buy a flavor taste like pork or beef if you were vegan anyway?
So
they're using a lot of chemical within it. There's a lot of way of doing processing, which people think it's quite dangerous. And the study they made in Italy realized that it is more dangerous than having a balanced diet with the proper produce.
And I
kind of agree with that, unless, like I said, there's a medical reason. I think a balanced diet is much more complete within your body. That's why we are omnivore and not carnivore. Mm. We can take everything, but people need to measure. The problem, some of my friends I know, I keep telling them, eat 14 times meat a week. I mean, this is insane because they're all from South African background or from Argentinian background and all this kind of thing. For me, I will never do that. It's not possible, but I look after myself quite well. I touch food. But a balanced diet for me is the most interesting. And dose it and variety of thing, but buy great produce. I think if people can, obviously, I know some people don't have the purse for it, and I can understand, as you know rightly, because some people come in a food bank because they don't have that. They got a family of three, they can't afford it. But at least, you know, there's some good produce still to go around, which you can balance stuff.
So, Daniel, as traditional is in this series, the guest of the current episode poses the question to the next guest. Now, I know you know who the next guest is. Please don't tell the listeners.
Yeah.
What's the question have you got for him?
Well, no, I love that family. I'm very passionate about what I learned from them. And I kind of stick to what I learned from them all my life as a guideline. One thing I want to do with that family is one day to judge the scholarship.
Okay.
Because I'm passionate about it. And it would be, for me, to kind of take my hat off to both his uncle and his father for what they gave me, and I'd like that very much. Yeah. So even if it's only one time, it doesn't matter, but I would be very proud because it's just a legacy which I'd like to, even for me to complete what I've done with them, in a sense, because I respect them and they've been amazing. So,
okay. Well, I'll ask him when I see him on later this month.
We never know. Could happen.
Well, a big thank you to Daniel Gamish and to Vanessa Clark for taking time to be with me here in the studio. It's been a real pleasure on this nice warm day in London.
Thank you very much.
I hope you both enjoyed it.
I've learned so much today from Daniel with things that I never knew before. Yeah, so it's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed myself.
Vice versa from your company, which is fantastic. So, and thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
It's a great pleasure.
Well, that concludes this episode of Kitchen Curiosity. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, the fourth episode. Again, we've given you some food for thought, some trends in the sector. A big thank you to our listeners for tuning in as we lift the lid on the hospitality sector. If you've got any questions for future guests or subject you'd like me to cover on the next episode, please drop me a line at radford@kitchencuriosity.co.uk. On my next episode, I have an extraordinary chef with three Michelin stars who has an undisputable passion for food. He's a master pâtissier. He's quoted as saying, "Desserts are his passion." He's chef patron of the Waterside Inn, which is the only restaurant outside of France to have three Michelin stars for over 30 years. He's a member of the Roux family. He's also joint chairman of the highly accredited Roux Scholarship. I'm delighted to say that we'll be recording from the Waterside Inn, which is the home to the Roux Scholarship. We'll also be joined by a gentleman who is a chef by trade, who's qualified at one of the most prestigious institutes in the UK, Westminster Catering College. He runs the UK division of a UK-Swedish warewash firm and is seriously passionate about reducing water, energy and chemical usage in the food service sector and has a wealth of knowledge in our industry. Click subscribe to follow us. If you have a moment, please rate the podcast and don't miss out on the next episode coming on the 10th of June. I've been your host, Radford Chancellor, and you've been listening to Kitchen Curiosity.